ever since I started playing or doing anything like playing sports or anything like that, was imagining the entire scenario in my head before I did it. And I would do this for auditions. I would do this for lessons, and I do it for shows. I do it for the album. I do, you know, whatever it is. I just, you know, the night before or in the morning, I take as much time as it is and I just play it. I play it out in my mind.
Welcome to episode 78 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. LemurMusic.com, everything you need for the double bass. Stop by their website and enter the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off of everything you need for the double bass. I could list a bunch of stuff again. I could. I could talk about bows. I could talk about rosin. I could talk about bow cases. I could talk about onyx wheels. I could talk about bags. I could talk about amps and etude books and all this stuff. Double bass players, you know the gear. Stop by LemurMusic.com. Enter the promo code TheBassShed for 10% off. D. Lakin Basses. While I was recording this, Dan actually called me. He called me back. So I picked up the phone and held it up to the mic, and here's Dan Lakin talking about it. Hey, Dan, how you doing? I'm recording this for the ad. I'm going to record our phone conversation.
Oh, good. Well, yeah. All I want to do is say, you know, just real quick, you know, stop by Dan Lakin Basses. And also, I'm going to start selling used, buy and sell used, pre-owned, if you will.
that was not planned. That he just called me while I was in the middle of doing the thing. D. Lakin Basses. I'm a big fan. I play a 5-string fretless. I play another one of his 4-string jazzes. I play a 4-string jazz bass of his. I play a 4-string jazz bass that is a D. Lakin bass. I don't know the best way to say that. The 5-string fretless I love. I currently have it strung up with a high C string, so it's tuned E through C. I brought that to a gig last week and folded pretty hard. I'm still getting used to the C string. But love the bass. Love the bass. Stop by dlakinbasses.com. Finay.com. Finay.com. It's a place where musicians can upload their recorded work and sell it. It is more lucrative than a streaming service. That is the aim of the company, is to be very pro artist, in the favor of the artist when selling recorded work, albums, singles, whatever you got. Head over to finay.com or stop by their booth at NAMM. They will be by the Pioneer booth. You can also listen to episode 56 of the Bass Shed Podcast to learn more. Finay.com. On the episode is New York bassist Matt Aronoff. Matt Aronoff is a double bassist, a jazz double bassist, and has a new record coming out titled Morning Song. I got hip to him because his PR team reached out to me and asked me to do the interview. And before I said yes, I checked him out. I checked out his record and I checked out his website. I wanted to read a little bit more about him before I agreed to do it. There's some things on his website that were interesting to me. And when I really sat and listened to the record, and this is kind of always my gauge when PR companies or management companies ask me to do interviews, I always want to just sit with the record. And if I don't like the record, or if I don't have questions, if the record doesn't ignite anything in me, then I don't do the interview. But luckily, the folks that do ask me to do interviews, they always are representing great artists, and the music is always intriguing. And so that was the case with Matt. I checked out the record. Loved the record. The record, again, titled Morning Song, is coming out June 3rd, and that is a digital release. Matt and I are going to talk about that. Here's a little bit of press about the record. And these are some things we did not cover in the interview necessarily, or the conversation didn't go there. But I do think this is interesting information to understand kind of where he was coming from with the record and the material. The record is dedicated to his father. Aronoff began writing these compositions shortly after he learned of his father's cancer diagnosis. From uncertainty, fear, and disappointment to acceptance, serenity, and joy, the composer's myriad of emotions can be heard on each track. So now this is a quote from Matt about the album. I wanted to create a juxtaposition of peacefulness with unrest and jovial melodies up against unstable harmonies and structure. You can hear that. You can hear that. Matt and I do talk about the compositional approach to this record. We discuss it more in a counterpoint way of talking about it. We don't necessarily talk about it in an emotional context. But I think knowing that is interesting because it can be heard, and that is communicated on his album. It's really, really interesting writing. And there is all that, everything that he was hoping to create, you know, that he said in that quote there, that he wanted to create a juxtaposition of peacefulness with unrest and jovial melodies up against unstable harmonies. All that can be heard. It's a brilliant record, and check it out. I will have links to it at thebassshed.com/podcast/Matt Aronoff. And here it is. Here's my talk with New York jazz bassist and band leader Matt Aronoff. What country are you in right now? You're on the road?
I am. Yeah. We just arrived in Switzerland.
Okay.
So today was one of those semi-gnarly travel days, but we don't have a show tonight, so it's kind of nice.
Nice. Who are you on the road with?
I'm out here with an artist named Sarah Gazarek. She's actually from LA. Maybe you know
her.
Man,
I used to teach across the hall from Sarah.
Okay.
At a music store.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Super small music store up in Montrose called Grayson's okay. Toontown. She, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So
she's great.
Her and
she's great.
Yeah. We've been playing together in, I think, now maybe 5 years or something like that.
Okay.
It's been nice. Yeah. And so just with Jonathan Pinson on drums and Julian Shore.
Okay.
Crapus. Yeah.
So, I don't know Julian. I know Pinson.
Sure. Yeah. Julian is a great pianist in New York. So we're kind of like half LA, half New York at the moment.
How long is the tour?
Well, I've been out here for about a week already. I was doing something in Valencia with Magda Gianicu. Do you know Banda Magda?
That sounds familiar.
She's part of the Ground Up music family, you know, Snarky Puppy and all those things. She was on the family dinner, and she's an amazing singer, composer, arranger, accordionist. So we kind of had a little thing in Valencia for a few days. She's heading up the program, the Berkeley program out there for a few years. Yeah. And then I met up with the Gazarek crew.
Yeah.
And we have about, I think, 10 days and then back to this, hopefully back to the States.
That's the plan.
Man, we're all a little bit on edge with like the reentry.
Right.
Because, you know, I don't know if you've been out to Europe since this whole thing, but
I haven't actually. I'm supposed to go at the end of June, and I have not been doing my due diligence of like staying up on what everything's at, but
yeah,
fingers crossed. I hope I'll hear something if there's an issue.
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
mainly what the issues that have been sort of like on the forefront are it's just reentry, just back to the US. Like within Europe, you're totally fine. It doesn't exist out here anymore.
You know?
It's like no masks anywhere. People are just getting on with their lives. They're going about things in a very cavalier way, which is, you know, it's cool if you can live that way, but getting back to the States, you can't be that way. So you have to test in order to get into the States. And then it could be as long as 10 days before, you know,
that could get crazy.
Yeah,
that could get crazy. That thing's been going around a little bit in LA. I have some friends on some tours. They haven't been affected, but people on their tour have. You know, and so I have some friends in Michael Bublé's band, and there's a trumpet player in Bublé's band that got it, and so he's sitting out some run they were doing to Detroit, I think, last week.
Okay.
And then another friend of mine does some road work, not with a jazz artist though, but he's super nervous because he thinks he might be coming down with it, and like doesn't want to affect all his road dates coming up.
Yeah, it's still, you know, it's still scary. It's still like really affects freelance people of all kinds.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. I think everybody kind of, I mean, here in LA, I don't know what it was like in New York, but here in LA, everybody kind of had this almost out of sight, out of mind thing, you know, for the last few months. Like, okay, it's over. Everything's been lifted. No mandates. Cool. Back to business. And then this new surge hit, and it's like, oh, all right. Oh, back to this. How long have you been in New York?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey.
Okay.
So I've kind of been in the area my whole life.
Right.
My first teacher was John Weber.
Okay.
And I don't know if you know John. He's great.
No.
I mean, amazing bebop bass player. I mean, like, just so swinging. This guy is, and he's also a phenomenal guitarist as well.
Oh, really?
And, yeah.
Does he play electric too, or just like just super classic jazz and guitar? Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, kind of got like a West thing on guitar.
Okay.
And just like, you know, Paul Chambers.
Right.
Through and through. I mean, he's ridiculous. So I kind of lucked into finding him when I was starting the instrument, and I would just go to his place in the city. I was like 15 minutes outside of New York. And so, and then when I was thinking about going to college, he's like, man, don't go to college, just join my band. And we're good.
I completely agree with that.
I mean, so do I, but it was challenging as like a 17-year-old trying to convince my parents, who are not musicians, to be like, yeah, John says that I can just join his band and it's going to be cool. You know?
Right. Right. Yeah. That's a hard sell to the folks. Like, no, I don't have to go to school. I'm just going to be in a band instead and everything will work out.
Yeah. So that I did not have the conviction at the time to like really to do that. So I ended up going to school and leaving New York.
Okay.
For 4 years, or maybe 5 years or 6 years, whatever it was, because I spent, you know, I studied in Pittsburgh, and then moved to Spain for a little bit and studied in Spain.
Okay.
And then, came back to the States.
Were you studying jazz or classical in Pittsburgh and Spain?
Well, in Pittsburgh, I was studying both classical and jazz. I was studying primarily classical bass technique.
Sure.
And then I was Eric Kloss's, you know, TA. I don't know if you know Eric Kloss is a really amazing saxophonist from Pittsburgh. He's a blind saxophonist
and
has been since he was maybe 3 or 4 or something like that. It was later on in life when he became blind. And I mean, he was a phenomenal musician. And so as when I was his TA, what it meant was I would just go pick him up from school, from his house, drive him to school, you know, and he would play me all of these, you know, bootleg tapes that he had from, you know, because he's at the moment, he's probably, I would say he's probably 70. So at the time he was maybe 50. And so it's like him playing with Dejanette, with Pat Martino and Dave Holland.
Wow.
And like, you know, it's like some really heavy shit. And like, and so we would do the, you know, take the trip twice a week. And then I would just hang out in the classroom with him and I would just accompany him, whatever the class was. So if it was an ear training class, I would do that with him. And if it was, you know, an improv class, I would do that. And so that was sort of my jazz, like, education in Pittsburgh.
Right.
You know, I would also go to, like, there's a great session in Pittsburgh that was led by Roger Humphreys and probably still is going on, you know.
Okay.
but, and Dwayne Dolphin was there and learned a lot from that scene. But, you know, so that was sort of the Pittsburgh connection. Yeah. And then, but I was sort of on a classical path. Okay. So, I found this guy in Spain that was a student of my teacher in Pittsburgh. And my teacher was this, Anthony Bianco, who was sort of, at the time, I think he was probably 83 years old.
Oh, wow.
You know, had the knowledge, the classical knowledge. I mean, he played under Toscanini. He played under Reiner. Like he was like,
okay.
He's had, you know, he was in the Pittsburgh Symphony probably for 45 years, something like that. You know,
at that age, was he still playing or was he just an educator?
At that age, he was still playing. Really? I mean, like he sort of had, I think during the 4 years that I was there, I think, you know, they kept moving him further down in the section, mm-hmm. you know, because there were so many young, great players.
Of course.
But they still wanted to have him in the section, you know,
yeah, yeah.
So he was still playing. But that was also one of the main reasons why I wanted to study with one of his students, I didn't know what the sound production could be like on the instrument. He could never really show that to me. And yeah, you know, there's something about a younger teacher just to get that, mm-hmm. to hear how you can really play, you know,
right.
some of these excerpts or the solo pieces or stuff like that. So, so I just kind of found this guy, Francisco Fernandez
okay.
in Pamplona. And I mean, it was crazy. I arrived and he basically gave me an apartment in the city. I know,
amazing.
In the middle of this is like, it's a generosity that I don't see. It blows my mind.
No.
I
think anywhere in America, that's pretty.
I mean,
that's not a thing.
Yeah, this is something that, you know, and it's, I've always tried to remember this and try to be. I think there. I mean, there is sort of a brotherhood, a family. There's a better word of brotherhood now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but like a family. That happens with bass players, the community,
sure.
you know,
yeah.
that you just want to give, you want to share. There's like an understanding. And I think this is part of it, you know, but yeah, he gave me the apartment that had three upright basses in the apartment. It was like a two bedroom apartment. And he would come over every other day or so. And he would just give me lessons. And it would just like, we would play etudes together and then like go work on his farm a little bit or whatever. And this was, you know, for a year pretty much.
Hmm.
And it was amazing. It was,
yeah.
you know, one of the, it was, and so that kind of brought me to like in the classical world, I auditioned for the orchestra out there. That was my first and last classical audition because it was, I mean, at that, it was, yeah, just like the stress of it and went pretty well, you know, like I couldn't have asked for a better audition.
Okay.
But I didn't win it.
Yeah.
And at that point it was just like, okay, how did I get to this place? How did I
yeah.
get to like playing a classical audition in Spain?
Where were you at internally during this? Like when you're going out on the classical audition and you're in Spain, how did you feel about this? Did this kind of appease the inner artist within you of like, yeah, I'm doing what mm-hmm. I want to be doing. This is your dream come true. This is, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm here. Or is it like, all right, I'll go check out the audition. Like, did it really make you come alive? The idea of being a classical bass player or in Spain or in general, like, did that really kind of scratch the itch for you?
I think that it was a long time ago. So I'm going to have to imagine some things here, but I don't think that I was thinking about being an artist or having the creative itch. I think really at that moment I was like, I just want to be able to play the bass
right.
in tune and yeah. like,
and
in
people
time.
Give me money for it. Yeah.
Yeah. it was sort of thrilling for sure to like mm-hmm. get into these classical pieces and play
yeah.
them. But it was never why I picked up the instrument to begin with. Like I really, I mean, I picked up the instrument because of Mingus. Like I heard Charles Mingus, like in New Jersey, there was a radio station that would play for every like jazz great's birthday. They would play for 24 hours. They would play that person's music.
I like that.
It's amazing. Yeah. And so I heard him and I just like immediately fell in love with the upright sound. And so that was, if anything, it was just sort of a wake up call after that audition, just being like, this was not the path that I ever saw for myself.
Sure.
And I mean, I was always playing jazz, even in Spain, like I'd be like the only jazz bass player in Pamplona, but I was doing it. And then came back to the States and sort of refocused my mind on that, and ended up deciding to go to grad school at Manhattan School of Music.
What years were you out there?
I was there. I dropped out in the middle. Yeah. I think I graduated in 2006. And okay. I think I started maybe in 2003. I went 2003, 2004, dropped out, and then came back.
Okay.
So that was sort of the time. Do you know some people that were there around that time?
We could probably go down a list of names of people who might have been out there. Off the top of my head, a couple piano players, Matt Politano, Max Hamer, who's on the road with Arturo Sandoval now.
Yeah, I know Max, but I know Max through Sarah, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. A bass player named Chris Finney was out there, I think, just after you. He was doing the classical thing, studying with Oren.
I might have known him, just not known his last name, because we were all in that same hallway. There's one hallway with all the bass players. But
Yeah. I went out there. This was probably 07. Like, I went out to New York and stayed with that bass player, Chris Finney. We went to Manhattan School, and then we went to the jam at International House.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We stopped by the jam there. There's some other people. I think, what was his name? I'm blanking on his name. Something Silverstein. He's been on the podcast too.
Jamie Silverstein.
Jamie. Left-handed player.
Yeah, we were there at the same time. Yeah.
Who else might have been there? Phil Dzak.
Sure. Yeah. We know Phil.
Yeah, there's a handful of people I know, but I don't remember all exactly when they were there.
Yeah. So I, basically went there and it was funny because, like, in the year that I took off from the school, and in that year, when I came back, one of the bass players that I knew from before, he's like, listen, the only advice I can give you is get yourself into Luciana Souza's vocal combo class. He's like, she is amazing. Like, you're going to learn so much. Like, this is, and so basically, because of, I was able to sort of negotiate some of the terms upon coming back to school, without going into too many details.
Yeah, so that's another type of reentry that got a little sketchy.
Off air, I'll give you this. I just said I want to be in her combo, and so I was, and it was phenomenal. I mean, I learned so much being in that class, and then like right out of that, she hired me for her band.
Okay,
and so I graduated and did like her last year before she had her baby. For some reason Scott Cawley was unavailable for that, and I was just in the right place at the right time and got to do a lot of work with her. For that year, and sort of introduced me to a bunch of, then I got to, after her, got to work with Peter Eldridge and record a bunch with him and just a whole slew of phenomenal singers in New York, which has been definitely a big part of my life.
Okay.
Which I really love.
Yeah. Do you really like playing with singers?
I do.
I think you can go either way. For me, 100% depends on the singer. I mean, and I'm sure you'd agree with that. And that goes with any instrument. But if they really know how to sell the tune, then it's so fun. You know, if they're just kind of like getting through a tune so they can do some kind of solo thing on it, then it's not as fun. But when they really get into a tune, like really get into a tune and the lyrics of a tune and are looking to convey that song as it was meant, that's the best.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, 100%. I don't know if I could compare a bad saxophonist to a bad singer. I think that if you're playing with somebody that's just not happening, it's not happening regardless of
the
thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But there is something, I mean, really vulnerable about being a singer, putting yourself out there on stage. And I don't know if you've ever like sung or led a band that way, but
just talking about that actually on the last episode. I'm getting ready to put together some tour dates for a record I have coming out later this year. And like the idea of being a front man freaks me out. And it's just a jazz, you know, who knows what it'll all go on the road with, maybe a trio, maybe a quartet, but at best, like, it's a jazz quartet. It's not like I have to be Bono. It's not like I have to be like a frontman. I just have to talk a little bit between songs. And that idea freaks me out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've gotten to some real squirrely places just talking.
Yeah.
You know, having a conversation with one, you know, one-on-one is, you can most of the time read what's going on, but then sometimes you're in front of an audience and you're like, oh, this anecdote that I thought was kind of that I normally would go over well is just like dying. And now I seem like an insane person.
You know? You're bombing. You're bombing as a frontman.
Yeah. So, you know, what ends up happening is you just introduce the band one more time because you're like, oh, that will get me out of any situation.
Yeah. That's the safety net.
Yeah.
How does that affect, excuse me, how does that affect the music after, like, let's say you bomb, you know, you're feeling really uncomfortable or you're not getting this feedback while you're talking and engaging with the crowd. How does that affect your playing? Are you super inside your head or can you shed that real quick and kind of get out of your head and get out of that feeling to go back to just really being in the music? Or does that come into the tune a little bit and it takes you a minute to settle down from it?
I think I can settle down pretty quickly.
Okay.
Like I think that I can very easily separate from what, like something that just happened. And then if I'll take a minute, recollect, I'm okay with the space. I'm okay with the silence in between, you know, if I'm okay with that feeling and then making sure that I'm in the right place, I think to then count the band in, start the song off or whatever it is. And I mean, I'll get in my head about other things,
of course,
you know, in the middle of the song.
There's no shortage of things to get in your head about. There's always something you're navigating.
Yeah, that's a constant struggle.
Yeah.
Or not a constant struggle, but it can happen, you know. And I think that, but usually the talking part, I don't pay much attention to after it's happened, you know.
Do you like go into a concert and you have anecdotes prepared, like, okay, when I introduce this song I kind of slip in this cute little story or talk about the history, or just like, hey, I'm Matt, I got a bass, now we're gonna do some stuff?
I think a little bit of both. I certainly have not gone the route of like really preparing anything, which by the way, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
And I think that, like, you know, putting on a show and being able to like really entertain is a great skill. I think that, like, when I imagine having a show, if I'm like, this is something that I've been doing ever since I started playing or doing anything like playing sports or anything like that, was imagining the entire scenario in my head before I did it. And I would do this for auditions. I would do this for lessons. And I do it for shows. I do it for the album. I do, you know, whatever it is. I just, you know, the night before or in the morning, I take as much time as it is and I just play it. I play it out in my mind, you know, okay. Like how this is going to go into this. I mean, obviously you're not playing out all the details. I'm just thinking about the songs and how they're starting, how they're ending. And then I will have an idea of like, oh, okay, I'm going to have a minute to talk about this song right. In between there. Like,
is this just kind of to think through the process, or does it get into for you almost like a manifestation exercise where you're kind of manifesting this vision that you have, or just thinking through it so you can wrap your head around some loose ends?
I think at least two of those things. If I don't know if there was a third one, but definitely.
Okay. I don't know either.
But definitely wrapping up loose ends, or like trying to make sure that everything has a good arc to it, mm-hmm. and making sure that what I would feel like if I were sitting in the audience, what I would want to hear, that's all I can really kind of imagine. And then the other part is a manifestation, for lack of a better word, but it was like, I remember growing up playing basketball and this study that was like this, it probably is not even true. I had heard about it, where it's like they had three teams. One team didn't practice at all. Mm-hmm. One team only practiced. And then the third team imagined practicing and practiced, did a little bit. Right. And the third team, the one that was imagining it, imagining doing free throws, imagining like really visualizing,
yeah,
and whatever word you want to use, was consistently the most successful team.
There is something to that, man. Like, I've done that when, like, I know I have a bunch of material to play like the next day, you know, and it's all so close, you know, like you learn a bunch of material and there's like just these little things that separate each tune. Like, oh man, there's so many details to keep straight. So many details. And if you just, I'll practice it on the bass, but then step away from the bass and just kind of think through the tunes and think through playing the tunes. And regularly, if I go through that process, there's more retention of the material. It's a strong tool that I completely subscribe to. That's great. And this actually kind of leads me to visualizing this arc. Kind of leads me to your record, because I hear that within each tune, there's like a really beautiful arc within each tune on your record.
Thanks.
Before we talk about the song specifically, as a composer, what influence did Mingus have on you as a composer? Was there a conscious influence where you'll go back and like check out what he's doing and kind of deconstruct some of his material?
You know, I don't think there was anything conscious. I think I think that I've learned a bunch of his music, so it is definitely seeped in on that level. And there is there's something that's so strong about his counterpoint, which I think is definitely something that I think about, and probably a lot of bass players are constantly thinking about, mm-hmm. I imagine, that I've always loved, and try to at least incorporate a little bit of that into the way that I'm hearing melodies versus bass lines and harmonies.
There's a track four on your album. Forgive me if I butcher the title. Hogdman?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hodgman.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That was the first thing I was aware of on that tune, was the counterpoint and kind of the interplay between what I'm hearing melodically and this bass pattern, idea or motive, whatever, that you're playing. And that shifts. It almost felt like the structure of the tune. And I guess I didn't want to get into tune by tune. Now I'm taking a deep dive on this track, but
no, it's okay.
That one almost felt like kind of modular, in the sense of like, there's these not just sections like you would have in a standard, like an AABA or something, but this one had definite shifts sectionally. Talk about the layout or the compositional layout of that tune. This is track 4 on your record for everybody.
Yeah.
Who hasn't checked out the record yet.
Yeah. I mean, and if you haven't, well, actually, it depends on when this comes out. Actually, I was going to say, because it hasn't come out yet. So
yeah, that's true. Yeah. What date is it? Hold on. So actually, while we're talking about this, so the record comes out June 3rd, which is actually, I'm going to pull this up. Well, let's see what day of, when is that?
It's a Friday.
That's a Friday.
Yeah.
That is not next Friday, but the Friday after. So this will probably come out, this conversation will come out on the 25th. So the following week will be is when they can hear your album. Let's plug that real quick while we're talking about that. That will be where will that be? On all the digital places?
Yeah, all the digital places, Bandcamp, only digital release actually.
Yeah.
You know, I will have I have a few physical copies that I'll sell at shows and stuff like that, but pretty much Bandcamp, Spotify, and you know, you can go to my website and you know be able to find it if you just type in my name, I'm sure. Yeah. Somehow it'll pop up.
We'll come back to the track and the counterpoint in a second. What was the decision to do just a digital release? Besides being like a lot less to think about, you know, I mean, like it's a lot to think about and pull together and it gets expensive really quick.
Yeah.
Especially if you're going to do the vinyl thing and all that.
Yeah. I think part of the decision was what had to do with that was just like, this is, wanted to put it out and I wanted to get it into the world. And I kind of wanted to get, it was supposed to be out in 2020, right? Okay. That's when I was originally going to put it out. And then due to the pandemic, it just took a backseat. Right. Sure. And it took a big backseat. And so I just put it on the back burner. I didn't think about it for a year and a half.
And it was already recorded?
Already. Yeah. I recorded in 2018.
Okay.
You know, so this was, I'll just back up a little bit if you're interested, but I used to co-lead a jam session in Brooklyn for 5 years. It used to be called the Soda Session, and then it transformed into the Nest Session.
Okay.
And so this great guitarist, actually, you might know him, Perry Smith. He's an LA guy for a while, right?
I know the other New guys. West. Yeah, I know the other dudes in that.
Yeah.
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 Brahm and Story.
Yeah. They're both good friends of mine.
Okay.
Sweet dudes. So, and I think I probably hooked up with Perry through John Story.
Okay.
Anyhow, we led the session for about 5 years. And when we were handing, and it was a great session. It was a very welcoming session. It was something that we really wanted to have a place where people could come and feel comfortable and not feel like,
I like they're getting vibed.
Yeah. And also that, and we wanted to sort of, make it, I know this sounds stupid, but just like as musical as possible. I know jam sessions can be so challenging to really make music with like strangers in the moment. And I personally, I've never been somebody that went to a jam session. I'm somewhat of a person that like that kind of situation. I get anxiety about. It's like something I don't want to really put myself in that position.
Especially as a bass player. I mean, if you walk in and you're not the house player, then you're like, you know, hey man, I'm Ryan, I'm gonna be playing, you know, whatever, you know, 50 courses of rhythm changes in a second, you got to go adjust the end pin, like quickly check out the bass, like where everything's at, how it feels, how it responds. It's a pain. And then you got a room full of musicians that are going to judge you for not even playing your own instrument. It's awful. It's a traumatizing experience is what it is.
But this, so we really tried to, and it was great. We, you know, every week we would have a special guest in the house set, you know, and so basically like anybody that you could think of that lives in New York and actually in LA would be a special guest at some point, you know, like, you know, And it usually be two people, like a drummer and horn player, or keys player, you know.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was like, really you and Perry that were the constants, and then there was always a revolving cast after that.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we would try to get, like, you know, big name people in to sort of have, like, and totally different, like, you know, we'd have Jonathan Finlayson, we'd have Donnie McCaslin, Gilad, you know, like Ari Hohn. It would be like just like a whole slew of Dan Weiss, like people that you wouldn't necessarily mix together. And we would just like see what happens. And
that's
cool. it was a lot of fun and a great learning experience. And you know, so when I knew that we were going to end that thing, I was like, I kind of wanted to do a live recording at the space to sort of, as a culmination of those years there, to sort of commemorate it, whatever. And so that's where this recording came from in 2018. Okay. Was when we stopped that session, and I was going to put it out in 2020, and then that happened. And so anyhow, we fast forward, and at Europa Records, they suggested just a digital release.
Okay.
And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. It makes sense for obviously environmental reasons. Like and it makes sense financial reasons. Like, let's see what the world is like with, you know, just a digital release. And so this is an experiment, trying this out and seeing how it goes.
That's cool. I like that. Cause I mean, I've talked to so many people about that have done records, you know, within the last few years. And I'm just like quizzing them all, you know, like, okay, man, if you did just a digital thing, like kind of what was your return on that versus the person who would print vinyl, you know, without like some download card inside. But then what about the guy who prints vinyl with the download code inside? And so I'm just asking everybody, trying to gather all this information. And I mean, it kind of makes sense for, this is your debut record, correct? As a band leader?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And
for like the debut record, which it's mine also, like, okay, like nobody knows what they're getting into. There's no like fan base. No one's dying to hear this, you know? So like, why do I got to put all this money behind it just to have a closet full of vinyl, you know, that's never going to moved?
Yeah. I mean, I put out that singer that I mentioned earlier, Peter Eldridge. Mm-hmm. He and I had a duo record together.
Oh, cool.
That we put out, you know, in 2014 or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I had the experience of having box fulls of CDs.
Yeah.
And also, like, you know, I had an ex of mine who's a phenomenal musician, amazing, you know, one of the best of the best. And still our closet was filled with, you know, 15 boxes of CDs. It's like, it's really, no matter, it's not a CD world anymore. You know, like you're buying these CDs and I mean, you're creating them, but who's buying them? Not many people are.
Yeah. So I thought that like CDs was, you know, that wasn't even on my personal radar.
Just vinyl for you.
Just vinyl, only because like I'm super into vinyl right now. Like I'm, like last night, it was part of my night of like going, like looking for a new turntable and like just nerding out on like every aspect of the turntable, you know, and why is this one $700 and this one's $3? Like, what's the difference? Okay. Like what are the variables I need to be aware of? And that's what I did last night. I'm getting super into it. You know,
I understand that.
Like two preamps, like, oh man, a tube preamp for the turntable would be sick. Let me check those out. And then I'm just, that's how I spent my night.
Yeah. No, I get that.
So I would, like, I like the idea of vinyl because I would purchase vinyl, but.
Totally. Yeah.
But they're also like expensive. I think it's like, you know, $2,500 for a box of 100 or something. You know, so even if you sell them at $25 a piece, you might break even.
Right.
You might break even. Yeah. You know, and cool. Yeah. So back to composing.
Sorry. Yeah,
no, that was my I sidetracked us. So talk about counterpoint. Have you formally studied counterpoint?
I spent some time studying it. I think most classical undergrad programs is it, you study 4 years of counterpoint, or at least maybe at least two. I don't know, but I've done a lot of counterpoint studies, and so this is the way that I think most of the time when playing and when writing. It's definitely coming from that. Also, I'm not a great pianist too, so it's certainly like easier when I'm thinking 2-3 parts at a time instead of, you know, instead of trying to really play the entire chord that I'm thinking of and the melodies. So it does help to kind of be able to do those things. And with that tune Hodgman, for example, that one is quite strong, and I think in the counterpoint that you're talking about, and I do agree that it is modular, like you were saying. It is a rhythmic cycle that expands throughout the tune, and then it does get into a repeating section of this rhythmic cycle, but it's somewhat additive the way that the rhythmic cycle works.
Okay.
And it's also somewhat minimalistic. Like the bass line doesn't change that much, but it changes just incrementally as the tune progresses. And then also consistent with that, as the tune progresses, the harmony starts opening up as well. It starts, you know.
Yeah, that tune and some other tunes on the record, which I have a sheet of notes here somewhere. But there's almost on every track on the record, there's this element of like slow burn to all of them. Like it's, you put it on and like Rhodes, you have Rhodes on the record, Fender Rhodes. And that's such a kind of soothing and relaxing sound. And it's like, okay, cool. Like this is going to be a chill record. Like, all right. Thankfully, and thank you for this, that it is not a hip hop jazz record. I don't get into that thing that much. But I'm like, okay, so this is kind of mellow, cool. You know, the first tune is the title track, first song on the record is Morning Song. That's the name of the record. And it's chill. And then it's got some, it just like slowly develops, and each track really has a band sound, and it's not, the record isn't a blowing session, which I absolutely appreciate. It's not, you know, we've all heard those records where like, okay, the material isn't as important as the improvisation of the soloist individually.
Yeah.
You know, there's definitely those records throughout jazz history, and contemporary artists are releasing records like that. This one was definitely a band sound, and it felt like a band approach to communicating this music, which I really, really enjoyed, because that was a breath of fresh air for people that listen to jazz regularly.
Thanks. Yeah. I think that's definitely something that's in my mind. And even going back to Mingus, you know, his tunes are like that in a way. Yeah. I mean, they are these, I mean, to me, like, they're in a way, like, it's the whole entire song that is the song. It's not just the, you know, it's the melody and these, like, sometimes they're brief solos, but those solos are really kind of perfect for the song. And you can't get them out of your head. And it's like, these are the versions in a way. They're it's not a pop song, but it almost feels like that's it. That's it. And so when I'm,
it was like a legit composition, not a lead sheet that everybody's gonna, you know, take a turn doing their thing on, but it's a tune. It's a piece of art. It's a piece of music that, I agree with Mingus.
So that's definitely part of the game plan with all of these songs. It's just like, this is the melody, this is the harmony of this section. Mm-hmm. And then we like Morning Song, for example, that one is maybe the blues at the end of the album might be the most like inside of a normal, like kind of blowing, but even that still, I think is really more, I certainly appreciate you noticing that it is a band sound. This is like, this is what I wanted from them. This is why I you know, why this is the band, because this is how they play with each other. Like, I wanted it to be conversational. Sure. I wanted it to be, you know, the lines between the melody and the solos to be blurred a bit. And I wanted parts of the songs to be blurred. Like when, you know, when we're morphing into a next section.
Yeah.
That also, everything I wanted it to seem very seamless.
Mission accomplished on that front. It was great. It was great. Because it doesn't, I never felt like I'm listening to like, I never listened to a track on there that I could like write out a quick cheat sheet, you know, for the tune and be like, all right, we got 16 here, bridge. And I kind of went to minor and then back to C section. And now, oh, there's an interlude before the next soloist. Like a lot of those little tricks that happen within jazz vocabulary, I didn't hear, which was great because I'm burnt out. I'm burnt out on hearing them. Like anybody can play that that stuff, and it's cool. The playing is going to be great, but when you encounter compositional devices so much, you get burnt out on it. And like, I want to hear something new. And your record's fantastic because it took me to a different place.
Thank you, sir. Well, I'll get you a vinyl then.
Yeah.
one single vinyl. I want to print out 100 just for you.
Yeah, I think the single vinyl, like that pressing, is probably going to cost 200.
That's right.
So there's six tunes on the record. Did you record more than six?
No.
Okay, you just did the six.
That's just the six. We did two sets. That night we did two sets, so I was able to at least pick, you know,
a version,
you know, but I went in with six and
came
went
out with six.
Yeah.
good.
Which, by the way, you know, like that, it was funny. It was a little bit of somewhat of a high pressure scenario because going back to the band leading thing, right? Like I'm not a big band leader. Like I'm not to say I'm not a big band leader, but I don't do it. And certainly in 2018, I didn't do it often. So, and also this night was going, so we recorded, but then it was going to be the jam session afterwards.
Right.
So
you had a lot on your mind.
Right. So we're setting up the whole room for recording, you know, which I have to, you know, you have to kind of like change the bar to make sure that it's good for the recording, but also, and then set up the drums, set up the Rhodes. Right. Jason Rigby, who's the saxophone player on the record, who is amazing. And I've been playing with him for 15 years. I love him as a human, as a player. If you don't know him, just go check out anything he's done. I mean, I don't know if you checked him out, obviously, with Mark Juliana. He does a lot with him, and his own records are great. But anyhow, he couldn't make any of the rehearsals for the band, for the gig. We had gigged before, and so he's played the music before, but the rest of us were able to kind of get together and play through it a couple times, I think. Maybe twice beforehand.
Okay.
In the weeks before, but he was just too busy doing other things. He couldn't. So he drove up, I think from Baltimore, he was teaching in Baltimore, drove up that night, kind of like barely made downbeat.
And then, how are you feeling about this? Were you like, he'll be here, it'll be cool, he can play, it's fine. Or are you also just kind of like, what the hell, dude? Like, what the hell? Like, I got a lot on my plate tonight. I don't need this level of stress now too.
I think I was more like, I know he'll be here.
Okay.
You know, like he was sending me texts like, hey, I'm on my way. But, you know, like I knew he was going to be there. I knew he was going to show up. But he just came in on fire too.
Right.
Like that was just the minute we started that first song. And the first song on the album was the first of all of us playing because.
Are they on your album in the order that they were played?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. It's good to know, actually, that this is the same experience we have as listeners that you guys had performing it. I like that.
Yeah. But, like, he just came in on fire, and it was everything that I wanted.
Perfect.
Was just happening. And, like, that was just, like, when we started playing, and everything just felt good immediately. That was just like, okay, this night's going to be cool. It's going to be fine, you know. And then, you know, little things afterwards, like, I remembered I remembered after the second set that Henry Coley, who is the drummer on it, he's such a sweet guy and really understated, like kind of quiet. He, you know, like on every gig in between sets, he's in the back just shedding.
Okay, he's that guy, yeah.
You know, he's constantly practicing. He's an inspiration just to be around. But like in the beginning of the set, he's like, you know, I'd really like a third cymbal stand, you know, because we didn't have one. And I didn't remember until after the second set that he asked for it. And I never got it for him. And he never had it. And he never complained and sounded killing anyhow. You know, it's like just those little things of like band leading, trying to compartmentalize all these things at once that night, that some were success and others, you know.
Yeah, it's a lot of hats to wear. I remember when I did my record, like because of that thing, because like the leading, I don't want to see the leading thing isn't part of my nature. Like I feel like I can be good at it, but I don't have the personality where I'm just going to come in and be like, all right, you do this, you do this, right. And like micromanage or give a ton of direction or, so I called people that I knew really, really well. And have already played with, you know, and I think that's common. And dudes that have played with each other a lot, so I didn't have to do that. Like that was my angle to sidestep it. If there was anything specifically I heard, cool. But other than that, like I know how they all play. Actually, there's one dude I had never met, the bass clarinet guy on my album I had never met before, but I wasn't worried about it. But cool, it's like just everybody do their thing. If there's something I'm really picky about, I'll chime in. But I don't want to have to give direction.
Yeah.
I do think that as a band leader, you have a scope of how you think and things you like to hear. And, you know, but then that runs the risk of everything having those characteristics to it. So everything's going to have this, you know, there's not going to be new ideas or new information interjected into this stuff. So the more I talk or the more I gave direction, I think that was going to stifle it. So I kind of just like, do your thing. Like, I trust you. That's why you're here. Go for it.
Yeah.
Unless it's awful, which I know it won't be, you know.
And if it is awful, then most likely even then, you might not say anything. You just won't hire that person the next time. You will maybe give them a second shot. Be like, you know what? They could have had an off night. That's not what I normally, but at a certain point there's no notes that you can give to people about something, you know, it's just like, okay, this is just not the right direction that I'm going. But even just going back to the band leading and sideman thing, I think that I'm sure, just like when you lead a couple times, then it just makes you such a more empathic side person.
I was going to ask, how did this process of really solidifying your own music and your voice within music as a composer, as a bass player, and you're getting ready to put this out into the world, how has that changed you and how you, not consciously, but going through, it's a heavy thing to do a record, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy. How does it shape you when you show up to a gig now? Are you more confident? Does it change how you're a sideman, as in like more respectful or more catering than you would normally be, or bring a different aspect to it where like you're bringing a different level of strength to the music?
Yeah, I think that it's just made me a little bit more, I think I've always sort of been patient and compassionate, but like I think it made me just a little bit more aware of the stresses, the insane amount of stress that is involved with behind the scenes. Like anything I can do to help a band leader out, I'm there. Like even if it's helping somebody else out in the band, it's like, Can I help the drummer carry some gear? Can I like, you know, help the band leader carry a suitcase? Anything, because the load of leading is just so tremendous.
Agreed.
Like you have the venue up your ass. You have, you know, are they selling enough tickets? You're wondering like, are people going to show up?
Sure.
Are, you know, everything is on there. You know, and obviously, you know, if they've been doing it for decades, then they're used to it and they're probably cool with it. They might not need the help, but I think that.
And then if they're a vocalist in addition, I mean, I say that because I know you're out with Sarah right now and I do some like regional work with the singer, how that's affecting their voice. And then if their voice isn't 100%, then they get inside their head about their voice and they're freaking out a little bit, you know, like, oh man, like, I don't know, this isn't happening. Like I'm tired or I'm scratchy or this climate change is doing this thing. The singers, because their instrument is their biology and their anatomy, you know, all those things affect them and their headspace in a different way.
I was just saying that I think that another thing that it made me recognize as well is actually we were just talking about people maybe not cutting it, something that didn't do what you wanted or whatever. It made me think about how I view the people that I've hired over the past or whatever, and how much like respect and love I have for them, and like how I'm never like, if they, let's say they did make a mistake, or let's say they did something, made a choice that I would never have made, or like I still like, I don't judge them in any negative way. And so I kind of want to give that to myself, a little bit of that generosity to myself when I feel like I played like shit, which happens, you know, at the end of a lot of gigs. I'm like, man, I, you know, like I should have done this. I could have done that better. But then I, for a moment, I'm like, well, you know, I try to put myself in the band leader's position and say, and listen to what they really are saying. Like, oh, that was one of that was like one of their best gigs ever or something like that.
Right. Right.
Even though I felt like shit and I'm like, all these, I'm like, okay, you know, it's like, okay, well, I'm just going to eat my emotions and let that be the real, like the takeaway from the gig or something like that, you know?
Yeah. But instead of suppressing it, just to change the verbiage, because I do think that there's power in this verbiage. Instead of just suppressing it, what fundamentally or ultimately you're saying is you're learning to show yourself grace instead of stifling it and burying it and sweeping it under the rug and being like, whatever, if you didn't notice, then I don't care. That's not the takeaway. The takeaway is showing yourself it's some self-care, and so you're showing yourself some personal grace.
Yeah, like
which is much out there.
I'm still gonna go home and work on the things that I feel like I didn't, you know, I didn't nail or. But I'm also not like there was certainly a time in my life where I would take it personally and I'd be like, you know, this person must hate me for you know, playing this note here instead of there, whatever the, you know, you can think of. Or not hate, but you know, and then realizing no, that music was happening.
Yeah,
and one little thing here or there—that's just our own obsessive nature to kind of like be, you know, the best that we can be in every given moment.
Sure.
That's the
goal. Knowing that this was recorded live at the club, how did you record it? Because you have a very interesting. On the record, that's the only time I've heard you play, so I'm sure this sound is the same live also, but it's a really, really interesting bass sound. So I listened to the record with headphones and it sounds like there's kind of a mid scoop in like that's a really punchy bass or a microphone or maybe both. Like there's a ton of punch and a ton of bottom end. But it also it didn't sound like there was just a smiley face, you know, in the EQ. like everything's very well contoured in the bass sound. It's still very clear. It's clear across the instrument. Everything is detailed without hearing a really brittle high end, but it never lacks in like this just roundness and punch too. What kind of bass is it? Like, what's the bass and how much of that is the bass? How much of that may have been added based on the room or the microphone or blah, blah, blah?
Yeah. Well, first off, thanks. I appreciate you. All those things are what I look for in a bass sound, you know, like the punch and direct, like center of the note is something I definitely go for. But if I don't handle, then you might be frozen. We might be.
Are we frozen?
Disconnected.
I can still see you. Can you hear me?
Oh. Okay. Yeah, I got you. Yeah. So, So I feel like that's definitely the sound that I try to produce playing, right? And then anything as far as EQ and like my, I wish I was better at this, but I couldn't really tell you what the engineer, there's a guy named great saxophonist who actually also plays from time to time in Buble's band. This great guy named Matt Morantz, who does a lot of live recording, and he's actually got a bit of a studio in Brooklyn now too.
Okay.
So he did the engineering and mixing of the record.
Oh, cool.
So, and I was with him when we did it, but I honestly couldn't tell you what we did.
Sure.
Or what he did. It was just sort of like, we wanted to get the bass sounding. You'd actually, he's a neighbor of mine, or he was at the time. So I remember actually before the gig going over to his apartment with my upright and just messing around with a bunch of different mic placements.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a bunch of different mics.
Sure.
And so we kind of figured out where the sweet spot was on this bass. And we tried our best to get it, but it was also challenging because the drums were right there. We had no baffles. So he kind of, I think he mic'd the amp because I was using an amp. So I think he mic'd the amp. And then we did one really interesting mic placement that was sort of a hack from Sam Manai, you know, bass player Sam Manai.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I haven't thought about him. Is he still playing with Tigran?
I don't think he is.
Okay.
But
I met him briefly right before he moved to New York.
Yeah. He's a phenomenal bass player. Yeah. And he's also a really great engineer as well.
Okay.
And so he told me, he engineered, I think the session, a record that I did. And, there's a sweet spot on the shoulder of every upright bass, like where a lot of the high end actually comes out of.
Okay.
So he'll put a mic on top of that shoulder to grab a lot of that.
So is this like the mic facing the joint of the neck and the body, like around a D or E flat on the G string, or is it closer to the scroll?
This is like literally like on the shoulder of the instrument.
Okay.
After this, I'll send you a link because I video recorded everything too from that show.
Sick.
So I can send you a link and you can see where the placement of the microphone is, but essentially it's not even, it's like on the side of the bass, like on the shoulder. Like,
wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
I was thinking like the shoulder of the bass, like where the joint is, but you're talking about your personal shoulder.
No, the joint.
Okay.
It's, yeah, the bout. Maybe it's like the upper bout. Maybe that's a better word for it.
I see what you're saying. Okay, yeah. Now I don't understand what you're at. Yeah. And I'm like, listeners might not have our, it looks like we're doing an air traffic control thing. Like I'm landing a 747 here on video. but cool, the upper bout. So interesting. Yeah. That's just like you get a harmonic pop there that really blows up the high end of the bass
You get, it's almost like a really focused sound of the instrument, like a really more of the high end that just jumps out. And and I guess if you kind of like have one of your friends play the bass or whatever, and you can kind of move your ear around and you'll be like, oh yeah, that's a sweet spot where that it's all coming out of. Yeah. So I guess so he likes that. So we tried to do that, but for live, it didn't work at all. I think that Matt was like, that was just a wasted mic. We didn't capture anything, but you'll see it on the video. Maybe we may have gotten a little bit of high end from that. But anyhow, going back, the instrument that I play on is a Benjamin Patoka. It's a 1893 Czech bass. It's a flatback bass. From what I have been told, is that it was Miroslav's bass. And then he sold it to Andy Gonzalez.
Okay.
And Andy Gonzalez had it for a while. And Kachow used to play on this bass like when he was in New York. So,
There's some, if even like a percentage of that is true, there's some serious juju on it. Like I remember when I bought the bass I have now. I think it was a line of shit, but he's like, man, this bass used to be Ron Carter's. This used to be, and I'd play it. It doesn't sound like anything that I have, It doesn't sound like any of the albums I have with Ron on it. Like, really? Right. This is his bass? This doesn't... I don't... Okay.
You're like, I like this bass anyhow. You don't have to...
Yeah, like, dude, you didn't have to go all the way there. At least come up with somebody that's more believable.
Right.
Because I don't know if this one belonged to Ron. Like, Ray Drummond, I could see that.
Yeah, so I've never got confirmation. I've tried to find, like, photos with Miroslav and a bass that possibly could be this bass.
Yeah.
And I it's hard. So I don't know. But the person I bought it from is a great bass player here in New York. And I trust him. So maybe someday I'll find out the truth about it. But
yeah.
But yeah,
great sounding bass.
It's sort of like it records really well. It's not like a super, super loud bass.
Mm-hmm.
But it does have, it's got a lot of punch and clarity, and so we were able to get a pretty decent bass sound. Everything considered, live albums are hard with bass sound, and especially in a scenario like that in a small stage. And you know,
I could definitely tell that you guys were playing together in the same room live, but it didn't sound like a live album. If that makes sense. Like, it still sounded like you guys were all just in one big room in the studio. And I didn't really realize that it was a live thing, a live situation with a crowd, until I heard the applause. And then I'm like, okay. There's people there. Interesting. Yeah. But that didn't dawn on me. I think it's a really great sonically, it's a sonically sounding record. I think the mix is well. I think the bass sits in the mix well. You know, there's no, you know, you run this competition of like the bass and the kick drum, because jazz kick drums are tuned so high, you know, and then they're like, that can get into a lot of the sonic real estate of where the bass lives. I didn't hear any of that. It's a good sounding record.
Thanks.
Yeah, man.
That means a lot.
June 3rd
is June 3rd. Are you talking about the release?
Yeah.
Yeah, release of June 3rd, and then and then it's out in the world.
Are you gonna you putting together a little tour to support it or do some promo?
I don't think I'm gonna have, unfortunately, I've got a release show on June 4th.
Okay.
You know, in Brooklyn, with most of the band. Henry is still in Puerto Rico, but Ross Peterson is playing drums, so I'm super excited about that. And Jason Rigby and Yago Vasquez are still going to be there. And actually, Harish is going to do an opening set
by
himself, like a solo bass set, which I'm super excited to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, he's one of my heroes. And Ambrose's band, like with Harish, is certainly an inspiration and always has been, you know. Compositionally and playing wise, like, you know, that's something that
I've never heard those two together. Like, I've checked out Ambrose stuff and I've checked out Harish, but I've never checked them out together. How long has Harish been in his band?
For a long time. I mean,
really?
So for like, certainly three albums I can at least, and he still is touring with him.
Maybe it was Harish I heard on the Ambrose record then.
Yeah.
Okay.
I bet it was. Yeah. So, I mean, in that live Vanguard record, that's Harish. And,
okay.
Heart Glistening or I always forget the titles of his records, unfortunately.
That's because they're paragraphs. Like,
it's hard to like remember. I mean, I can like visualize what these records are.
Yeah, and they always have like tune names and album names they're pretty extensive. Ambrose is amazing. But sometimes it's a little too floaty for me. Like, I gotta be in a mood to check him out. Mm. Like, sometimes I just want to listen to Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, I feel you.
You know, just like. Just drive this thing home. Sick. So what's the where in Brooklyn? What's the venue?
It's a venue called The Owl.
Okay.
It's a great little club in Lefferts Gardens. And I've been a regular at that place for a very long time, and it's intimate room. And I love playing there. And so We're going to do a quick show there on June 4th. And yeah, let's see what happens after that.
Nice.
I'd love to tour with this band a bit, but you know, it's also, it's challenging at the moment. So we'll see what happens. And see if we can get out on the road and do some stuff.
Did doing this record kind of, there's something really addicting to the studio thing, and not just as a sideman, you go and you cut a session. Okay, cool. But there's something about for me being a leader and going in and doing a record, there's like this high associated with it. I'm like, yeah, I just want to go back in. I just want to go back into the studio. I want to cut another record. I got an idea for another record. You know, like I have the concept for it. I have zero material. Like I haven't written anything, but like, I want to go back in. That was so fun. Blah, blah, blah. Did that happen to you where you kind of just like really got this itch to do more and record more? Or have I some ideas, you know, do you like to communicate artistically?
I think that I'm almost the exact opposite of what you're describing, in the sense that I actually do have a lot of material that I am, but I don't have that drive yet to go back into the studio and get it on.
Yeah.
Get it down. But I know I'm going to give this record a little bit of time.
Yeah.
And then I've got essentially like these two smaller suites that I'll probably do on another record.
Oh, that's cool.
That are kind of based off of a movie. One of them is based off of this Danish movie. Another one's based off of a poem that I read, and they're just like, they're two small suites that I think might make a nice album. And so, but I don't have that, like, I really need to get in there and do it. I know a lot of people like you that have that get that.
It's completely impulsive. It all is. It's like, I want to feel like that again. So like, doing this session gave me that payoff. Like, great, whatever. I don't care what happens with the music or whatever we just recorded. Like, I'm done with it. Like, I want that high again. I want to be a part of that thing. It's destructive is what it is.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are meetings for that. I think there are meetings that you can go to for that kind of
That was my talk with Matt Arnoff. I highly recommend checking out the album Morning Song. It's a brilliant record. And don't let it fool you. You put it on, you have the Rhodes, the upright bass. It's really relaxing. You know, like sonically, it's not an aggressive the palette of sounds, so to speak. But don't let that fool you where you just put it on in the background. Like, sit and engage with this record. There's a lot there. The record, I think, is just very understated sonically in how it's coming at you. But if you really sit and listen, there's a lot of stuff there. There's a lot of good stuff there. So check it out. Morning Song by Matt Arnoff. If you are enjoying the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it. If you are at NAMM, look for me. I will be be hanging out with the folks at Lemur. I will be over at the Finet booth. And I will just be wandering around seeing what's up this year and seeing what NAMM's like since they missed a year. Yeah, that's all I got for this one, folks. I will catch you on the next one in a minute.